Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, October 27th. I'm Ray Graff. The 2020 U.S. election season is now in the home stretch. 65 million people have already voted. Democracy is once again in full flower in the U.S. of A. Let's hope it's not a corpse flower. UAlbany political science professor Sally Friedman is on the line today to answer your questions about elections. It is intended to be an open forum, so give us a call. It won't cost you a dime, and you can add your 2 cents. The number is 800-348-2551 if you want to call in, 800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Elections, voting, Sally Friedman, your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Professor Sally Friedman joins us today to talk elections. Professor Friedman teaches American politics and methodology with a focus on aspects of political representation and the processes associated with a representative democracy. She's the author of Dilemmas of Representation, which highlights the balance of local and national elements that make up the styles of current members of Congress. This is quite an election season. If you have a question, anything political at all, we want to hear your thoughts. Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org, and we'll try to get to as many emails as we can as well. But the number is 800-348-2551. Professor Sally Friedman, welcome to Vox Pop.
Hey, thank you.
Nice to have you here. Exciting time to be watching politics, eh?
Yes, it is an exciting time to be watching politics. Never a dull moment, right?
Indeed. Well, you know, before we get to current events and start taking calls, just a moment or two on your book, Dilemmas of Representation. It got me thinking that just the title alone, in the grand scheme of things, what does representation actually mean? and given the way we have the population has grown and the diversity of the population, has the definition that our founding fathers thought about representation, has that changed?
So that is a really good question. So I think the quickest definition is something about you want to get represented on issues. I think the founders talked about trustees and delegates. Delegates, you listen to your constituents, in brief. Trustees, you sort of think you've got the better answers because you're a politician, you've got the experience. And so I think the founding fathers focused a lot on issues. I think in the modern day, I think what you said about diversity and increasing diversity is really interesting. In the modern day, we also talk about descriptive representation, diversity, the idea that if you have more women in office, are they going to represent more women? If you have blacks in office, are they going to represent more blacks? So descriptively, should Congress look like the country? You know, should Congress look like the population? And I think in the modern day, there's a lot of expectations that representatives just be accessible, be and do constituency service and help constituents.
You know, we lost you there for a minute, but finish that sentence, and then I'll go to my next follow-up.
You lost me because I think my phone's been ringing, which is really funny in the moment. But in the modern day, I think we expect accessibility. I think we expect constituency services, help individual people, bring projects to the district. So, great question. What is it for representation? And for each of us, what does it mean to feel represented?
And given this, the amount of population increase since the early days, you know, I don't know if Tip O'Neill said this first or whether he's just associated with it, but all politics is local, he said. First of all, do you find that true or not true? And second of all, how the heck does a representative stay local when there are so many people?
Yeah, so another good question. You're on a roll.
I don't know. That's it for the month, actually.
So all politics is local? Really interesting question, because so many national elements, and especially this year, 2020, coming into the election, you got to talk about President Trump. You got to talk about the race. You so much party polarization. You are, as a representative, part of your party. So is all politics? So I suspect the bottom line is that if you ignore the local too much, you're stupid. But I do think that the national elements, issues, national candidates are more important in local races, certainly congressional races, probably this year some state races, than they used to be.
You know, I'll ask you a few more here. We'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. The lines are loading up. 800-348-2551 if you have a question for Professor Sally Friedman today. The House has basically stayed static. The number of representatives has stayed the same for a long time, generations. Is it time to expand that, in your view?
Another good question. So I'm not sure. So I can see the arguments to expand it. You'd get better representation. You might get smaller districts, so more people might be able to get closer to their congresspeople. At the same time, I've read proposals that if you increase the House, I've heard proposals about like 675, and there's some arguments for that number, I think, that it'd just be crazier, madhouser, more partisan than it is. So, you know, how do you manage 700 people? But then you can say, how do you manage 400 people?
Yeah.
So matter of degree. But would it make things more partisan because there's too many people? And somehow would it take away from the stability?
So
pros and cons?
I think that's a good way to put it. Professor Sally Friedman joins us today from UAlbany. This is a time, and I mentioned this was an exciting time to watch politics. It's also a stressful time. And yeah. I think there are a lot of people out there who are disgusted or disaffected or whatever you want to say about the political system and the two-party system in general. And, you know, a lot of critics of this primary or the presidential campaign say, hey, this is the lesser of two evils. I'm going to vote for A. I'm going to vote for B. But if so many people say the two-party system doesn't really do it anymore, why don't third-party candidates do better?
And I also want to say about what you said, people might be disaffected, but the turnout rates in the early voting have just been awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, I was hearing things like numbers like 60 million votes already.
65 million as
million.
Of this moment.
Yeah. So, and you had a news story on while I was listening. Maryland set single day records for number of voters. So disaffection or whatever, but I mean, in terms of democracy, I mean, this is great.
Yeah.
In terms of people being heard. So the party system, I mean, I think lots of reasons to think a two-party system is entrenched. Winner-take-all elections, hard to get on the ballot for a third party in many states. Hard to get as much money for campaigns. So I think there's some built-in, you know, downsides for third parties. I do think third parties have probably made more difference than we think, even if we don't routinely have them. And I think if we started to have them, I mean, in some places that have them that are proportional representation systems, I was thinking about this, that there's just more instability in the government. So are there some upsides to a two-party system, too? I'm not saying that they are, but Professor Hatt says pros and cons.
Yeah.
And then the third parties, you know, especially if an election is close, even if they're not going to win, can make more of a difference than we think. So don't, you know, don't say they haven't done, that they haven't had an effect throughout their history.
You make a point. Our number here is 800-348-2551 if you want to talk to Professor Sally Friedman today. It is election season, and things are Things are at a fever pitch here around the country. As you mentioned, 65 million people have already voted. And yet there is always a conversation among political scientists about those undecideds. And why do some people make their mind up so late? It seems like this particular presidential election is fairly cut and dry. There are two sides here. And I have a hard time believing people haven't already made up their minds.
So when I was watching the debate last week, they were especially talking to some undecided voters, many of whom seem to have legitimate sort of weighing of possibilities. I like President Trump because of a law and order policy, but I don't like his thousands of tweets. Or I like Biden because he supports Black Lives Matter, but maybe he's not going to be as good for the economy or Wall Street. So are there legitimate conflicts about issues or Republicans that don't want to vote for the other party? I mean, are there legitimate conflicts?
No. In
people's heads.
I'll tell you what, Professor Friedman, I will not put you on the spot and have you predict a winner just yet. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. We'll take a short break. We'll get to your calls. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. The number is 800-348-2551. Professor Sally Friedman joins us. She teaches American politics and methodology at UAlbany and is the author of Dilemmas of Representation. All right, Sally, you ready to take some calls here?
Sure.
All right, let's roll. And we start out with Joseph. Where are you calling from, Joseph?
Five Towns.
Okay, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. I've heard talk that Amy Coney Barrett should recuse herself in the event of a Supreme Court decision that would decide the election. It was my understanding that one of the purposes of lifetime judicial appointments was to prevent conflicts of interest like this.
So I'm not sure what the legality is. I was talking to some people. I mean, yes, she was just appointed, and she was just appointed by President Trump. That's a really good question. When I asked somebody else about this last week, they sort of said maybe all the other two Trump judges should recuse themselves. I think it is so should all of the Trump appointees recuse themselves? That's a really good question. I do feel like, I mean, if you want an opinion that, you know, it's she got appointed a week before the election. Is there a conflict of interest? To me, there would be. Like I said, the opposite argument that I heard, I guess there's two of them, right? One is that, you know, one is that should the other Trump-appointed judges recuse themselves, and the other one is it just that, okay, so she's appointed, now she's a genuine member of the Supreme Court, that's it, nothing to be said. She gets to sit on the court. I think she was sworn in this morning. So
indeed. Well, Joseph, thanks a lot for the call. Professor Sally Friedman joins us today. Have you seen anything quite like that before? The entire, the very quick approval process for Amy Coney Barrett?
I have not. I thought I had heard that the average time of it takes to validate a Supreme Court nominee was like 60 days or something like that. So this is quick. I also heard, you know, if the Democrats had the majority, would they do the same thing? Maybe. 'Cause the stakes of a Supreme Court nominee. I think there is some literature on courts that question how far from the majority a court will in the long run go. So maybe the court won't be as conservative as some people think. and it's way too soon to tell.
I think that you make a fair point there. You know, there were previous Trump appointees that I think by some count, you know, let down President Trump on some decisions because yeah. these folks, I think, are doing the job they're supposed to do, right?
Yeah, and decide cases, and every case has its own story beyond sort of the bigger picture. And how do you decide on a case-by-case basis, or do you?
You know, with regard to representative democracy and your line of scholarly expertise, do we have too much media and too much information that is unfiltered for a good, well-working Democratic Republic?
Don't know. I think the thing that bothers me most is the polarization of everything. That you don't know when you're getting a straight story, or that you have to go out of your way to listen to opposite sides of a story to try to figure out where you stand. So polarization, you know, the Judiciary Committee is a really good example where the Democrats just didn't go to some of the votes as a statement. So how do you get people to talk to each other?
Well, you know, but I do think that if you look at history, and we will get right back to the phones here in a minute, 800-348-2551, Professor Sally Friedman joins us today. I do think that there have been times in this country, notwithstanding the Civil War, which is an obvious one, where this country yeah. has been very polarized.
Yes.
There is just not, there wasn't 100 years ago or 150 years
yeah.
ago that media microscope. But have things changed that much? I mean, there's always been this polarization.
And in our life, yeah, there's always been this polarization in the Constitution on the founding days, Federalists and Anti-Federalists, late 1700s, alien and sedition laws. They were pretty unhappy with each other.
Yeah.
Even though they came together and made a Constitution. After the Civil War, really partisan. But then in our lifetimes, what we have seen is polarization escalating. So have there been periods of polarization? Yeah, but they're more historical. So certainly when I was growing up, things weren't as polarized.
Yeah.
So you know, so on the one hand, there's history. On the other hand, what does it mean to us today?
Professor Sally Friedman joins us today on Vox Pop. Our number is 800-348-2551. Ryan is in Malta. Hello, Ryan.
Hi.
You're on.
If you get rid of the Electoral College, everyone's complaining about the Electoral College. Well, some people are. You're left. I think the other option is just the popular vote. And then it becomes a mob rule where the candidates will pretty much concentrate campaigning in California and the East Coast and leave everyone else out. Is there a third option that gets rid of the Electoral College, but we don't go towards the popular vote? Is there some other model that works?
Would one possibility be that they're trying to have states go for the winner, the popular winner? So could you modify the Electoral College? Could you keep it because it is a stable institution, right or wrong? And because if you took, I understand the arguments for that it's not democratic. I understand the arguments that winners, you know, that winners have not followed the popular vote, and at the same time, it's what we got. And if you take it away, will you be overchanging in ways that, like you were saying, Ryan, that you can't predict?
Mm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was wondering, do some states keep the Electoral College, but instead of having the states do a winner takes all of the electoral votes, if they do it proportionally, would that help out? Or is that too far towards the mob?
I think some version of proportionally. I mean, as it is, you get each state gets their number of representatives, right, plus two extra electoral votes. So I guess those two electoral votes are sort of weighting it towards, you know, away from sort of a popular thing, that you're getting a little more weight relative to your population.
Hmm. Well, Ryan, well, thank you very much for the call. The number here is 800-348-2551. Professor Sally Friedman joins us today. And the discussion about the Electoral College also harkens back to the Constitutional Convention, which, as I see it, there was a lot of debate about big states, small states,
yeah,
and this is more or less how the House of Representatives came to be. If we went that route, how do the small states still get a say?
If we went that's a really good question, and I think that's the issue. And I think going back to the Constitution, and today, COVID, how much reliance we place on the states. I mean, political science 101, you know, House and Senate, checks and balances. They're, you know, elected differently. They're supposed to have different functions. And just how big a deal the states, just how big a deal federalism has been in the Constitution and also just throughout history. And you're seeing, I mean, there's all kinds of examples of that, from marijuana laws. You know, some states have them, others don't. From how they handle immigrants, and COVID right now is the best example, where you've seen so much variation by state. So states, you know, I'm from Alabama, I'm from New York, I'm from Massachusetts, I'm from Georgia, have had such a big role throughout American history.
You know, one of the things that has been in the news, and I think it was even on NPR this morning, was a discussion about ranked choice voting. What's your opinion of that?
I think it would be interesting. Again, pros and cons. I like, you know, would it make things more complicated? Would enough people really have enough information to be able to rank the candidates, especially sort of when it's new, but 20 years in, are people going to pay attention to it?
Yeah.
Is it? But so I don't think it's a like the Electoral College. I don't think it's an automatic yes. But is it worth trying? Maine has it. I think there's a proposition on the Alaska ballot. Maybe some other states that are going to try it. I think some local areas have it. Does it give people more of a way to get, if not their first choice, their second choice in? Yeah.
Hmm.
I think it's worth the experiment. But I guess like all these experiments, it seems like, you know, we have a mood of we want to do this now. And we don't think about sort of, hey, there's another side, or in 20 years, is it going to be what we still want? And how often do you change the rules?
Yeah. No, these are good questions. Professor Sally Friedman joins us. Back to the phones we go. 800-348-2551, the number. Art is in Queensbury. Art, you're on with Professor Sally Friedman.
Hey. How you doing, Professor Sally? Hey. I got a question, man. Given the fact of how, you know, everybody's, you know, telling the situation at this point, you know, for either candidate, whether it is, you know, the current president or, you know, the one that is, you know, trying for it now, what do you think will be a good candidate or a good president for the United States at this point, based on your opinion?
I don't know. I think what's your opinion on that one? I think we all got our each individual opinions. I don't think there's a political science opinion, you know? So what do you think about that? How would you answer that?
You are a pro. Well deflected. All right, Art, it's on you. Go ahead.
No, I'm not going. Okay, you don't want my opinion.
No, I got you. Go ahead, Art.
I think it's complicated. Basically, it comes down to, you know, to the personal. I understand that. However, though, for the mass, I'm talking about what I mean with that, the general population, I think it's kind of tough because you have one person that has done something and the other person that is promising something. So that's where I'm coming. That's where I'm, you know, calling for, you know, asking for,
yeah,
you know, what is your opinion on it?
So that comes down to...
Sally,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, you raised something about incumbents, the advantage of incumbents, right? We know what more about what President Trump, you know, to the extent that he will do the same thing, you know, if he wins, that he has done, we can predict better what will happen. I think you raise a good point. And he's clearly, you know, and the other point he raises about the role of experience, right? And in this case, the experience of these two candidates has been really different, right? So,
yeah.
So that's what your question's making me think about. And then how is each, you know, you said what's good for the country. I mean, how is each voter gonna? Each voter's got to decide that, you know, how do you weight all the factors? You know, you're saying experience, you're saying incumbency. You know, how is the voter next door to you going to weight the, you know, what factors are they going to see, you know?
So, Art, you are undecided at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And you plan to vote, early or on Election Day?
I think I'm going to wait on Election Day. I mean, it's not easy. I think this year, I think it's kind of complicated.
It
is.
If you're undecided, what is it? You talked about some of the things you're thinking about, but what are you, you know, what factors are going to go into your decision? Where's the complication, you know?
Well, I think that... economy and safety is the priority in this country first. So they go hand to hand. Whether you put, you know, the safety first or the economy, that, you know, it's going to be where, you know, you got to make a decision. So on the other hand, you know, like I said, it's kind of tough, you know, because it's so much missing information from both sides, I consider it. And that's where, you know, you are like, what do you do, you know, like,
in many ways, you have to be your own filter, and you have to figure out what is real and what is not real, and it's very confusing for all of us, even political scientists, right?
Yeah.
Well, Art, thanks a lot for the call. You know, before we take a break here, and we will do that in a moment, you and I have both mentioned over the past couple of weeks that it seems that the electorate is energized. We see 65 million people plus have already voted. First question for you is... early voting a good thing?
So, again, I think I want to say yes and no. And I guess my no is, I don't know that I've taught a lot of sort of election day. The day really focuses you. Everybody's going to the polls at the same time. It's a focusing event. And we're all seeing... you know, and you don't, and where's the last minute surprise?
Yeah.
So I can see some complications again of early voting. Does it help democracy? It's got to.
Why?
It's got to just give people more chances, more conveniences, more working voting into their schedules. Should Election Day be a national holiday? Probably.
Yeah, I agree. All right, one quick question, and you can give me a quick answer, or you have up to a minute, and then we'll take a break. Professor Sally Friedman, is our Democratic Republic in a good place today?
I get 1 minute. I don't know. I think again, it's the polarization that's bothered me. It's the how hard it is to talk to people you disagree with. And so maybe like Art's call said a minute ago, maybe we need more people to think it's complicated, who can sort of go some versions of seeing it both ways.
You know, you're becoming one of my favorite guests. Let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551. Professor Sally Friedman speaks wisdom. We'll be back with her and your calls in a moment. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. The number is 800-348-2551. Professor Sally Friedman of UAlbany joins us today. Professor Friedman teaches American politics and methodology with a focus on aspects of political representation and the processes associated with representative democracy. By the way, have you voted yet, Sally?
No, I was going to go Thursday or Friday, and I want to do it in person. I just feel like mail ballots, maybe it's what you got to do. I guess I'm used to, I think you had a person on the news as I was waiting for this that was like, I'm used to doing it in person. I want to be there. I want to make sure everything goes well.
I'm going to wait for Election Day. It's fun to do it before I run into work, and it's an exciting day. Now, this political scientist I know, we'll get to the calls in a minute. There are a ton of them, 800-348-2551. This political scientist I know. Last name is Shark Talk. You may have heard of him. He's fond of saying you cannot have a democracy without information. So if we take that as true, is it a wise thing to vote early? Don't you want to gather as much information as possible?
Unless you think that you, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the downsides. The other side of it is if you think you are, especially this year, if you are decided and if no information is going to change you, and if voting early makes it easier for you to actually cast your vote, right? That's the other side of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go to Joseph in Amherst. Joseph, you're on.
Hi, thank you. A couple of things. One, I think the voting early thing, the problem with it is kind of like writing a review of a Broadway show if you've only stayed through intermission. But apart from that, I'm curious as to, we were talking about the undecideds. Professor, do you think the undecideds are a result of the fact that people support positions and issues, but not individuals, but they have to decide if that's a significant enough piece of information to cause them to go in that direction? And you guys already talked about ranked choice voting, but it sounds to me like it's phenomenally undemocratic to go with the ranked choice voting.
All right, Sally.
Because it ends up with people who didn't get the most votes getting the job.
I think that it is fair and probably, I mean, again, yeah, advantages and disadvantages, but I think the advantage of ranked choice voting is if you don't get your first choice, I mean, they want your whole, I guess I would have to look at exactly how they do the tallies, but they want your whole preference order. So if there are three or four candidates, you get to put your whole list down, and the formulas will take that into account. So in that way, that it's not just asking for your first choice, it's asking for all your choices, I think that it is democratic. So is it a little complicated? Yeah, but to the extent that it takes more of your preference order into account, that's probably a good thing. As to your question about... Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, in Maine, where, as you mentioned, they have it, yeah. Neil Peliquin won the contest outright, but he didn't get enough votes to get the position, right? Yeah. So the second choice candidate had more overall votes. I mean,
yeah.
You know, de Blasio was elected mayor of New York with 17% of the voters. So I understand the impetus behind it. But frankly, if you don't show up to vote, why should your vote be counted in the sense that people get 2, 3, 4? In some cases, it's gone on for like more than a dozen recounts before they get to an actual number where somebody wins the election, even though they didn't actually get the largest number of votes. Of course, because they just keep dropping off the lowest numbers first. And by the way, I just want to throw a quick thank you for your professionalism as a professor, because it seems to me like your students would be surrounded with your questions and not just your opinions. And I think there's a loss to higher education.
I noticed that as well. Yeah, she's good. All right, Sally, you want to follow up here?
I was going to say that my understanding of how they were doing it in Maine is that they had to count the ballots and stuff until somebody had a majority. That they were,
not a simple majority, because that was already done.
What do you mean, not a simple?
Pelequin had won the election.
With how much of the vote?
I think we Joseph. I think you went to speakerphone there, and I think it's tough to hear you.
Added them up again, and then eventually he lost the election, even though he received the majority number of votes in the first ballot.
I guess I would want to look at the numbers there. So I guess I don't know what happened. Like I said, the quick answer that I would give is I think what I said, that if it gives you a chance to count more of your preference order, I think that's probably the Democratic thing to do.
Okay, Joseph,
and
thanks a lot.
And I'd have to think more about what happened in Maine, because I guess I don't know.
All right. Well, fair enough. Our number here is 800-348-2551. James is in Guilderland. James, you got to turn your radio down there.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So I have a question about the potential outcomes of this after the mail-in ballots have been sent in. Is there a cutoff for when the counting ends? Or is anything written down about this?
I guess I don't know the exact dates. As I understand it, different states have different laws about that, and different states. So we were talking about states before and how important they are. And I think this is one. Somebody was telling me that, you know, in some states there are dates that the counting has to be done by. I think states vary in when you actually have to get the vote in. I think that's right. So, and I don't know New York's. I'm thinking that this is one where sort of it depends on the state. I know that it can depend on the locality in terms of where you can drop off your ballots has been an issue. So as I understand it, I think it depends on the states.
All right, James, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Sally Friedman joins us from UAlbany. Her book is Dilemmas of Representation. One of the things that I understand from your CV that you focused on in the past is social backgrounds of lawmakers and how it affects their behavior as legislators, in particular business. But I have a question for you before the next call. Do you think there are too many lawyers in Congress?
I have read some stuff that says I think we were talking earlier about diversity of an increasing diverse electorate, and if you want Congress to look like the country, then the answer is yes. I guess I recently read some stuff that claims that lawyers may vote differently on some legal issues.
Well, that's interesting.
So I guess, I guess it depends where. I guess the advantages of to the extent that lawyers have some of the skills you want for politicians, or to the extent that lawyers listen to their constituents as well as everybody else.
Yeah.
Then I think it's okay.
Okay. Well, all right. Then you're still open for that job at Albany Law. Let's go to Scott in Western Massachusetts. Scott, you're on.
Thanks, Ray, and thanks, Professor, for both the work. Not a lawyer, an electrician, but my question was about your sense of the history where the federalism, which I actually support the system, is used from the executive or even the congressional level to penalize politically states that, you know, we all contribute to a system, but maybe I don't like pick X state here, and I'm going to use these powers I have to penalize through that system. Mm-hmm. And I'll take your question off the air.
Great, Scott. Thanks a lot.
So is the question, so more specifically, should states who, I don't know, have handled the protest differently be penalized? I think my opinion might come in there, but or should states who need assistance after wildfires not be able to get it from the federal government? I think my opinion might come in there. But when do you allow state differences, you know, and differences in different cultures? I have friends in Alabama that have a really different culture from me. When is that a good thing? And when do you say we want a uniform standard for things?
You know, what, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, one of the things I've noticed is federalism could be a convenient soccer ball to kick around when blame is to be cast. In other words, a COVID response. Oh, it's a state thing. And then you can point the fingers at the states, and the states can say, no, it's a federal thing. And it seems to be a convenient excuse for whatever side of whatever issue you're on.
But in the COVID thing, that's one of the issues. That's the election issue.
Yeah.
What's the right response?
Correct. Let's go back to the phones here. Susan in Sunderland. Susan, you're on.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a million things I'd like to respond to, but one of them is nationally, I think we should have a federal mandate about the number of days when votes get counted. Right now, New York and Massachusetts have 3 days after November 3rd to continue the counting. But what I called about was the gentleman who was asking about how to choose when he's still an undecided voter at this point. And what I wanted to say is that aside from one of the problems with the way we hold our elections is we want that one individual person who we're electing to be the end all and be all when we put them in the presidency. And I think we have to look at not only what has the current president done, but who has he surrounded himself with? Who does he get his information from? Who does he take counsel from? And it's pretty clear that if you don't agree with the current president, you get fired or you get your reputation destroyed. So I think if we look at the current president or we look at Joe Biden and think about who is Joe Biden going to surround himself with? Who is he talking about? How will he handle the COVID? Who will he... listen to, whether he'll listen to the scientists or whether he'll listen to the people that he wants to hear. So I think it's really important that in making your decision, you look at the totality of how someone is going to run the government, not just the individual person themselves. And just lastly, I wanted to say to the gentleman who called about ranked choice voting, the vote he was talking about where Pelequin lost that vote, he had the plurality. He did not get 50%. Hmm. In order to win in ranked choice voting, you have to get 50%.
All right. Do you have a question?
Yes. I wanted to know if the professor could address, you said earlier, Professor, that there are ways that third parties have actually done more than we think that they have. So could you give us an example of what a third party has done either to help or hinder an election?
I guess I was thinking of two things at least, and I really liked what you said about, you know, who is the president going to surround himself with, whether it's the vice president, whether it's in the, you know, cabinet departments. I think that's a really good point. I was thinking of really close elections that third part in whether it's states or the nation, I was thinking that if it's really close, I think 2000, in Ralph Nader ran, and some people were really upset that they thought that took votes away from Al Gore. I think that's right.
Ross Perot.
I was thinking about Ross Perot in 1992, that ran on balanced budgets and people and didn't win, but people picked up those ideas for quite a few years.
All right, let's quickly go. We have time for one or two more here, and let's go to Hyde Park, New York. And Ron, you're on.
Yeah, let me just preface this by saying that my degree in political science was about 150 years ago. But I learned in political science 101 that the essence of politics is compromise. What happened? I mean, was there an inflection point in history where, I mean, why are we so polarized?
What a lovely question. Perfect, man. Perfect.
What's the impact of social media?
All right, we have about a minute and a half here, Professor.
So I just taught two articles about polarization, and collectively between them, they had like about 20 causes of it. So some people think it's the, so who knows, you know, so in a way, maybe it comes down to what do we do about it if we don't quite know how it happened. But some people, you know, causes about the electoral system. Is it something about redistricting? Is it something about the primaries? Is it something about, have people really gotten more polarized on issues so that there's just genuinely more disagreement in a diverse society? Is it stuff in the institution, new members in Congress getting more disagreeing with, you know, is it the new members in Congress and then their districts say they can do that? So I'm not sure. So there's a lot of dispute about the why. And having taught that last week, I was like, maybe we need to, I don't know. Maybe it's sort of, okay, what do we do?
Yeah. All right. One more question for you, and then we'll be done here in 15 seconds. Too much money in politics?
Probably. And I guess, and so then how much do you need to run an effective campaign? So you need money, and how do you regulate it?
Yeah. Well, we are done. And before we go, though, who wins on Tuesday, Biden or Trump?
No, we were done.
Okay. Hey, Sally Friedman.
So all the polls I was reading were just talking about how close things were, how close some of the Senate races were.
Yeah.
So I'm not going there.
Well, you know what? You've been great, and thank you. I hope you come back. Professor Sally Friedman, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Support comes from Excelsior College, online accredited not-for-profit college working to support adult learners and degree completion for nearly 50 years, accepting college credits previously earned and industry certifications, excelsior.edu. New England Hydroponics, offering a full selection of hydroponic supplies, organic soils, and indoor gardening equipment, located in Auburn, Marlboro, Seekonk, and Southampton, Massachusetts. The indoor gardening experts, nehydro.com. And Ashfield Stone, Shelburne Falls, Massachusetts, quarriers and fabricators used for enduring landscapes and interiors, including countertops and floor planking, rare and wonderful native stone of the Berkshires, ashfieldstone.com. Once again, thanks to Professor Sally Friedman of UAlbany for being here. Thank you for calling. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Jai Sheree Sukram answered the phones. Our producer, Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we'll get limber. We'll feel better. Our knees will feel good. Matthew Goodemo joins us. We'll talk physical therapy tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the book show.